from deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're living now. Things really all have changed. You know, a year ago I made fun of the fact that everything has changed. Well, and of course that was when all the media were saying everything has changed. Now that everything has changed, nobody's saying it except me. What's the problem here? Friday, the George W. Bush administration, he's the president, don't you know, it released its security doctrine for the forthcoming little while, our next little fun period. And it announced that the whole concept of United States defense in the last few decades or so, deterrence, is going bye-bye, because we got a new thing. We got preemption. Now, of course, the networks don't pay attention to this because they've been preempting for years, but he means something different by this. He means going after the enemies before they come after us. Although, I read the document. It looks more like the Ernie Banks doctrine of security. It's a nice day for a war. Let's fight, too. But a secret, this is from a newspaper in Glasgow, Scotland. Boy, you have to go a long way to find out what's going on sometimes. A secret blueprint for U.S. global domination, that's what they say, reveals that President Bush and his cabinet were planning a premeditated attack on Iraq to secure regime change even before he took power in January 2001. The blueprint was drawn up by Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Jeb Bush, and Cheney's chief of staff, Louis Libby. The document entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategies and Forces and Resources for a New Century was written in September 2000 by the think tank Project for the New American Century, or PNAC. It says the United States has for decades sought to play a more permanent role in Gulf regional security, while the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides the immediate justification. The need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein. The document supports a blueprint for maintaining global U.S. preeminence, precluding the rise of a great power rival, and shaping the international security order in line with American principles and interests. This American grand strategy must be advanced for as far into the future as possible. It also calls for the U.S. to fight and decisively win multiple simultaneous major wars as a core mission. That's what I'm saying, the Ernie Banks strategy. Let's fight, too. It also calls for the creation of U.S. space forces to dominate space. And it hints that despite threatening war against Iraq for developing weapons of mass destruction, the U.S. may consider developing biological weapons. But those would be good biological weapons. Those would be, ladies and gentlemen, nice germs. So, everything has changed. Now, you see, it wasn't true, and now it is. So, for the next hour or so, ladies and gentlemen, it's going to be my pleasure to, in line with my new doctrine, practice preemptive comedy. Hello, welcome to the show.
Left my spirit unfed for too long. I'm coming home to my family where I can be strong. Be who I plan to be. Within me, my ancestry giving me continuity. Would it be remiss to continue in this way? Would you rather I quit? Come with that other shit, making people hit this way. Lip service I pay, but I'm nervous. I pray for all the mothers who get no sleep. Like a lifeline, I write lines, cause my compassion is deep. For the people who fashion me, my soul to keep. And this is who I happen to be. And if I don't see that I'm strong, then I won't be. This is what my daddy told me.
I wished he would hold me a little more than he did, but he taught me my culture and how to live positive. I never won the shame of blood in my veins and bring pain to my sweet grandfather's face. In his resting place, I make haste to learn and not waste everything my forefathers earned in tears for my culture. For 27 years, yeah, that's right. My name's Bob, I'm the one who landed the pop star's job. I'm the one who told Luke, don't touch him, the kids wouldn't amount to much. I believe in the Simpsons sound of sound. I have always been screwed out. Won't you help me drown it out? I'm what I feel, what I'm feeling is surreal. Lace up your boots and go back to the roots. Speaking to my ghetto roots, freak, freaking for loot. And I still expect to check what your future brings. It's now, and your forefathers for the know-how. Go now into the world without hatred. Use your head, if the needle is wise, beat the threat. And weave ancestral wisdom, yours by birth. Spreading the Lord's word over this broad earth. This is what my daddy told me. I wished he'd hold me a little more than he did, but he taught me my culture and how to live positive. I never want to shame the blood in my veins and bring pain to my sweet grandfather's face. In his resting place, I make haste to learn and not waste everything my forefathers earned in tears for my culture.
faig i do adeus a 6 milions figurantes.
We are the last to know, ladies and gentlemen, from the edge of America, from the home of the homeless. I'm Harry Shearer, glad to welcome you among the ranks of the last to know. This is another edition of Le Show. I'm reading from this document, Rebuilding America's Defenses, written by the Project for a New American Century in September 2000. It supports a blueprint for maintaining global U.S. preeminence, precluding the rise of a great power rival. And the American grand strategy must be advanced for as far into the future as possible. It describes American armed forces abroad as the cavalry on the new American frontier. It supports an earlier document written by Paul Wolfowitz, now Assistant Defense Secretary, that said the U.S. must discourage advanced industrial nations from challenging our leadership or even aspiring to a larger regional or global role. Ask yourself if you heard a quote like this on American television lately. A Labour MP, Tam Dalyell, said of this report when he was informed of it, quote, "This is garbage from right-wing think tanks stuffed with chicken hawks, men who've never seen the horror of war but are in love with the idea of war. Men like Cheney who were draft dodgers in Vietnam," unquote, Tam Dalyell. I don't think I heard him on the networks this week. No, I didn't. The last to know, ladies and gentlemen. But just in case you think that the surfeit, the great abundance of corporate accounting shenanigans is basically defines the limit of accounting shenanigans, of accounting shenaniganisms. Here's something you may not have heard. The Interior Secretary of the United States, Gail Norton, was ruled in contempt of court this week by a federal judge who issued a blistering attack on her and a senior aide, saying they deceived him about the Interior Department's failure to reform a trust fund for Native Americans. She's the third cabinet-level official held in contempt of court in modern history, following two Clinton administration officials held in contempt by the same judge in the same case 3 years ago. What's the deal? It's a class-action lawsuit filed by Indians to secure an accounting of hundreds of millions, maybe billions of dollars, in royalties from Native American lands held in trust by the government. The government's inability to keep track of how much is owed to each of more than 300,000 Indians ranks as one of the biggest and longest-running accounting failures in history. Hello, Enron. Hello, WorldCom. Pikers, baby. The judge, Royce Lamberth, said the Interior Department handled the case in the same manner as it managed the royalties from Indian land, quote, disgracefully, unquote. So, ain't just the private sector that does bad accounting. Everybody can do bad accounting when they really set their minds to it, ladies and gentlemen. There's no limit to that. Here's another report. This got a little attention this week. It's got a nice bit of attention, actually. Maybe enough. The U.S. intelligence community received a... Well, I'm going to lead into this just by saying, and I'm not patting myself anywhere on the body to say this, but the broadcast that was done here, in this space, in this radio space, a year ago, immediately following 9/11, that is to say, the Sunday following 9/11 on most of these stations, except the ones that preempted it, I'd already heard U.S. officials saying, U.S. intelligence officials, I believe, saying, no one could have imagined flying an airliner into a building as a weapon. And at the time, I thought and said, isn't that what we pay people to do, is to imagine stuff like this, pay people in the government to do? Well, the U.S. intelligence community received a surprising number of credible reports of a likely terrorist attack prior to 9/11/2001, including some threats to domestic targets. The preliminary findings of the staff of the Senate House Intelligence Committee investigating 9/11 also showed that some intelligence analysts had focused on the possibility that terrorists might use airplanes as weapons. They did imagine it. Who said that nobody had imagined it? Condoleezza Rice, I think. Condi. The 30-page unclassified report raised serious questions about whether the U.S. government shared enough information with the public about what it knew to be a grave threat from Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda, not Linda Tyra, Al-Qaeda terrorist network. After, I'm not going to read the rest of this. You can go look it up for yourself. Anyway, at least some part of our intelligence community recognized what was out there, according to one official. But there are issues about information sharing with the intelligence community and between the intelligence community and the rest of the federal government. Unquote. No kidding. Yeah, 1 second comment. No kidding. The official noted it is not the intelligence community's job to warn the public about threats. Asked if White House officials who would make the call in a public warning were cooperating with the intelligence committee, the official from the committee said they've answered some questions and some maybe not. All right, we'll keep an eye on that, won't we? That'll be at the top of our agenda for about 4 seconds till we get distracted by something else. All right, then. Finally, on the subject of 9/11, on a more trivial note, Things went wrong at a Jersey City, New Jersey, September 11th anniversary ceremony last week when dozens of white pigeons were released. Some of the birds got tangled in onlookers' hair or fell, apparently, into the Hudson River. Ugh. Several were injured later when they crashed into office windows. Others were found dead. Instead of getting homing pigeons, the kind usually used at weddings and other formal events, organizers of the September 11th service bought their birds at a poultry shop in Newark. Who knew there were poultry shops in Newark? Apparently these people did. That's reprehensible, said Ellen Goldberg, a teacher at the nonprofit Raptor Trust Bird Hospital in Millington, New Jersey, where some of the injured pigeons were treated. That's not how it's supposed to work. Guy Catrillo, a member of the city's organizing 9/11 Memorial Committee, defended the decision to buy the 80 birds from a poultry shop, saying the city saved several hundred dollars, and said the pigeons were spared a much worse fate. They're all free, he said. They're not soup. Guy, do you have pigeon soup at your house? I haven't gotten the invitation, so. Oh, one more thing. A listener shares a letter he sent to sourcebooks.com. Dear sirs, I'm very this is the first I knew about this, so I'm sharing this with you. Because that's the kind of person, I'm a sharing kind of a. Dear sirs, I'm very disturbed by your marketing a book with the title 9/11 Beauty Secrets, which appears at your website. I'm not going to give the URL. American tastelessness and insensitivity in the name of crash commercialism apparently has no bounds nor any amount of accountability. Cashing in on the tragedy of so many people is plainly unconscionable. This is a sad day in U.S. marketing. However, I'm confident you will soon be joined by others using the same bad judgment. Signed, Ron in Oakland. 9/11 Beauty Secrets, ladies and gentlemen. Not me. Don't look at me. I didn't do it. I'm sharing. And now, something else doesn't work around here. But here's our regular feature.
We're so sorry.
The apologies of the week. These are big, ladies and gentlemen. These are big people apologizing this week. The whole thing is really catching on, the whole apology thing. First, the governor of Kentucky. How about that for big? I apologize to the people of Kentucky for my failure as a person. I have already apologized to Judy and my family. I'm also sorry that I initially denied mistakes I made in my public life. Sunday night, I was informed that an inappropriate personal relationship of mine was revealed to the press as part of a lawsuit that was going to be filed. My first response was to deny my unfaithfulness to Judy. I was wrong. The denial was another mistake. I knew what I had to do. I spent Thursday evening with Judy and our children and apologized to them and ask their forgiveness. I now apologize to the people of Kentucky and ask your forgiveness. Understandably, some of you may have less trust in me today than you did a week ago. Paul Patton, governor of Kentucky. Had an affair. A nutty affair. And is sorry that he had it and is sorry that he denied it. And is he running for election? I don't know. There were mutual apologies this week by the representatives, the heads of North Korea and Japan. Hey, isn't North Korea in the axis of evil? Yeah, they are. But we're not going to bomb them. We're going to let them apologize to Japan. That's even more painful. He has admitted that his country kidnapped 12 Japanese citizens, 4 still alive, 8 are confirmed dead. It is regretful, Kim Jong-il says, and I want to frankly apologize. That's a frank apology. Whoa, ladies and gentlemen. The two leaders held talks. He apologized face-to-face to the Japanese Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi during their first face-to-face meeting. Japan apologized in return. Mr. Koizumi apologized for the Japanese behavior. Where is it? Where did it say his apology? It's right here. He apologized for Japan's repressive occupation of Korea. That's both North and South, so I think he apologized to South Korea as well. And, of course, apparently at this hour, newly reelected German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder has apologized to the United States. His justice minister, Erta Dobler, I can't even read her name, was quoted as comparing the tactics the Bush administration was using to pressure Iraq with tactics used by Hitler. That got everybody in a bunch. Here's the quote. Bush wants to distract attention from his domestic political problems. That's a favorite method. Hitler did that too. It's not much of a comparison, but it was enough to ignite an international firestorm. Schroeder wrote to Bush saying, quote, I want to let you know how much I regret the fact that alleged comments by the German justice minister have given an impression that has offended you. Man, that's kid gloves, that's 10-foot pole, that's radiation tongs. He's distancing himself. It's alleged comments that may have given an impression that have... It's not what she said. It's something she was alleged to have said that might have offended him. But I'm sorry anyway. Let me assure you there is no place at my cabinet table for anyone who makes a connection between the American president and such a criminal. She, the justice minister, told reporters, it is absurd and slanderous to connect me to a comparison between a democratically elected politician and Nazi leaders. Hey, wasn't Hitler democratically elected? Yes, he was. Thanks for noticing. I deeply regret that this has thrown shadows on German-American relations. She added she has great respect for Bush. I don't think he feels the same about Germany. She told reporters in a discussion with union members she had mentioned public debate in the United States about how foreign policy could divert attention from domestic problems. I then said we have known this debate since Adolf Nazi. She said she had seen that people in the group appeared to have misunderstood this and then insisted that no comparison or connection could or should be made between Hitler and Bush, ladies and gentlemen. So don't even think that she said that, if you'd be so kind. Let's turn for just a moment to issues of rampant commercialism. The New York Times ran a story last week that rappers have discovered. You know, rappers have been doing records about their allegedly upscale lifestyle for years. And one way of authenticating the good lives that they're living is to mention the names of products that they're wearing or using or driving. All the way back to My Adidas by Run DMC. Thank you for remembering. Now they've finally wised up because it was a champagne brand was experiencing, no, it was some booze was experiencing a dramatic rise in sales after being mentioned in the title of a rapper's record. So now it's finally dawned on them, why do we charge for doing this? So the next set of references to objects in rap music will be the result of product placement, ladies and gentlemen. There goes that. And from the Chicago Tribune, the Skokie Park District touts Pepsi as its exclusive soft drink provider. And Elgin, Illinois' new recreation center will have a Lundstrom Insurance Agency locker room and Great Lakes Snow Systems climbing wall. In San Diego, visitors with heart problems may well be saved by one of the city's official automated external defibrillators made by Cardiac Science. A trend that has plastered corporate names all over sports fields and arenas is trickling down to the municipal level across the nation. In a twist in which buildings were named in honor of philanthropists or volunteers, many park districts, municipalities, and schools are now sticking a price tag on the naming rights to community centers and laundry rooms. Spend enough, a corporation can have an entire facility named after it, like the $8.9 million Schaumburg Park District's multi-sport complex under construction and looking for a donor. Have a tighter budget? For $2,000, you can get a racquetball court in Elgin, Illinois' rec center named after you. And, when rec centers and municipal buildings lose their integrity, that's one thing. But rappers, it's all over.
Isn't it a pity what you don't know when you're young? And isn't it a pity how we're headstrong and too high strung? Funny, when you're old enough and wise enough, you laugh at stuff that used to make you cry. Cause everybody holds on to someone who'll do for fear of being lonely. So throw him over, Juliet, cause he's a loser. He's a loser. He's no Romeo. And I know how long you waited, but you have to let him go, darling, before he turns you cold. Now I'm not the voice of reason, I just own all the things I've done. And I hate to see you suffer, but it's a lesson that must be won. I know that you're not ready to enjoy the view, cause you compromise yourself in this way. But everybody has a choice and has a voice, and it's better sometimes. Throw him over, Juliet, cause he's a loser, he's a loser, he's no Romeo. And I know how long you waited, but you have to let him go, darling, before he turns you.
This is Le Show, and this weekend we got the answer to the question, what do you do when Tim Russert or another hard-hitting questioner on a television yak show catches you in a rhetorical bind where you seem to be contradicting yourself? This could be kind of a postgraduate speech debate colloquium delivered by today on Meet the Press by Senator Wayne Allard of Colorado, talking about starting to talk about the federal budget. Well, he's not. That's not him. Here's him now.
I just think that we need to have some kind of a deficit reduction plan within the next 10 years.
But what would be cut if, in fact, you freeze all programs? People will say you're cutting farm programs,
yeah,
you're cutting environmental,
yeah,
programs, and you don't have a prescription drug program.
You know,
you can't have it all. Have tax cuts, a war in Iraq, and still balance the budget.
Well, you know, only in a Washington is the argument made that, you know, if you have a less of an increase in what somebody asked for, it's called a cut. We can, as members of the Senate, put in a budget that will balance it within 10 years. I don't think that's unreasonable, and we can do it to hold spending down within reasonable levels.
If you postpone the Bush tax cut, would that be a tax increase?
Yeah, I think it would be a tax increase if you postpone the tax cut.
Then if you froze spending, why wouldn't it be a cut?
Well, if you freeze spending, you know, like I say, here in Washington, If you spend the same amount of money in the previous year and you spend it the next year, I don't think it's a cut. As a small businessman, I never looked at that as a cut.
So when you're trapped, repeat what you said at the beginning and chuckle a little bit. Okay, you got that? All right, next week we'll see if there's another colloquium on another important subject for would-be politicians. And there are going to be more would-be politicians just around the corner. I'll get to that in a moment. But let's talk more about the ones we have already. As you know, President Bush not only made public the text of the new security doctrine, the preemptive security doctrine, but sent a resolution to Congress asking for what critics have described as a blank check, what Maureen Dowd in the New York Times described as a Gulf of Tonkin resolution without even going to the bother of phoning up a Gulf of Tonkin incident. A resolution that would give him the power to do what, to take whatever steps he feels necessary in his own discretion. Meanwhile, Saddam Hussein this week, of course, said, sure, send in inspectors, no conditions, and then started to waffle, some fine waffling. But it was enough to get certain nations, Russia, which has veto power on the UN Security Council, and whose representatives met with Bush administration officials this week. Russia is not so enamored of the idea of unilateral military action against Iraq. And interestingly enough, neither are some Republicans in the Congress. It may have to be dealt with soon and underground.
This spring.
Next, intimate tales of America's first underground vice president. The action-packed diary of a man who's less than a heartbeat away from history.
Dick Cheney. Confidential. 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 Confidential.
This past decade, thanks to low oil prices and 0% interest, America's had a love affair with the SUV. In the wake of a certain historic anniversary and the threats that surrounded it, I was renewing my love affair with the SUL, the secure undisclosed location. The bunker looked better than the last time I saw it. To my surprise, Lynn had, with Secret Service cooperation, of course, got the crew from changing rooms in there for a couple of days. So, for the first time since I moved in, the place didn't look like the nice end of an Atlas missile silo. Partial diary entry for Friday, September 20th. 10:15 a.m. Half an hour on the phone with FBI Director Bob Mueller. I suggested to him that it might be a better situation for all concerned if his agents didn't go up on Capitol Hill and sing to a committee from behind a screen like a shy Sinatra. Mueller? No, he couldn't have been more cooperative if he'd been a tipsy starlet on a columnist's couch. The day didn't stay so easy. A certain Republican senator dropped by to discuss our Iraq policy and our new security doctrine of preemptive self-defense. He wasn't particularly charmed about the logistics of his visit. 11:20 a.m.
Would you like something to drink, Senator Hagel?
Well, after that trip, I better. What do you have?
Well, he... secure and disclosed location prides itself on its hospitality. Something Caribbean and strong?
Sure. And you'll...
Oh, of course. The Lasonic blindfold. Mm-hmm. I have the code here someplace.
Well, I...
There you go. Code is new.
Huh. Almost seems like I see more clearly.
Mm-hmm. It's a known side effect. Mm. So, Senator, my friends on the Hill tell me you haven't quite taken your seat on the Iraq Express just yet.
Well, it's true, Mr. Vice President. Something about violating both the U.N. Charter and the U.S. Constitution just, I don't know, just mm-hmm. kind of rubs me the wrong way.
Well, and please don't take this personally, Senator. What can we do to rub you the right way? Unless you want to take it personally. I don't know if you're into that. The briefing book on you didn't...
Mr. Vice President, mm-hmm. what would rub me the right way would be the sense that we aren't quite turning our backs on four decades of a very successful security doctrine of containment and deterrence.
C&D.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Worked great. So did whale oil lamps, tube tires, and movable type. We're living in a new century, Senator. And you can't contain terrorists. They can slip across borders more easily than Guatemalan domestics.
Well, but we can deter Saddam Hussein. I mean, if he uses a weapon of mass destruction, we nuke him. He understands that.
Well, does he? Never underestimate the ability of a formerly rational monster to turn into a madman. That's what we think we're dealing with here. Senator, I know you're a student of history.
Well, I'm on the Agriculture Committee, too.
What if we could have known about bin Laden in advance? Would you have voted against preempting him?
Well, from what I saw at the Intelligence Committee hearings this week, we did know about him.
Senator, please. Let's try to keep this hypothetical.
I'm sorry, I...
Wouldn't you have voted to stop him by any means necessary? If you'd known a way to stop Clinton from taking office in 92, wouldn't you have... Oh, here we are.
Ooh, who's this?
Here's your drink, Senator. Just the way you like it. In a glass.
Ooh. I don't believe you've met Miss Ethanol.
Miss F?
Just a token of our dedication to turning around this country's energy policy. Mm. What way is she rubbing him?
I'll let you know. Excuse me, Miss...
Miss Ethanol.
Miss Ethanol.
I'll be in the next bunker when you need me.
She's a nice girl.
Mm-hmm.
But look, Mr. Vice President, the reason I came down here today, despite the last-minute nature of your invitation...
Well, I can't appear on anybody's calendar at this particular moment for security reasons. Mm-hmm. Same reason I'm wearing this rather baggy-looking suit.
Composite materials?
Let's just put it this way. I don't show up on anybody's radar.
All right. Well, anyway, I think a lot of Republicans in the Senate would like to support our president.
Good.
We'd like to be on board.
Fine.
But we just haven't seen the compelling evidence that says, yes, now we have no choice.
Okay, Senator, I was with you up till the last one. I'm being facetious, of course.
Of course. Boy, this has got a little kick to it.
You don't know the half of it. All right, Senator, you're on the appropriate committees. You have the appropriate clearances.
I sure do. Gee, the fog's coming in early tonight.
Mm-hmm. So I guess there's nothing for me to do but to, in fact, show you the compelling evidence that you've been asking for.
Yeah, yes. Evidence is nice.
Mm-hmm.
Gee, this room is very purple.
I'll just get the dossier.
Mm-hmm.
You like your drink?
Drink likes me. you said it's Caribbean.
Mm-hmm. Cuban.
Oh, Havana?
No, sir. Served exclusively at Guantanamo. Interesting evidence, no?
Oh, the best.
Sure, drugging a senator's drink might appear to some people to be from the old school. In which case, I plead guilty. With an explanation. I guess you could just chalk it up to bunker mentality. End of partial diary entry for September 20th. Sincerely yours, Dick Cheney. Confidential. Confidential.
I Tell me, who are you? You tell me what to do.
Talking about possible additional politicians, ladies and gentlemen, in the wake of the success of the reality game show American Idol, in which viewers helped choose the winner of a contest to receive a recording contract, cable channel FX, owned by Rupert Murdoch, hey, Roop, is set to mount an endeavor that will culminate in the American public voting on, quote, a people's candidate, unquote, who could run for president in 2004. The program, American President. It's a reality series. 100 candidates will start the series. During subsequent episodes, candidates will debate as well as have other competitions, unspecified at this point. The number of semifinalists will be whittled down each week based on live audience response and telephone internet voting. Each episode will originate from all-American locales like Mount Rushmore or the Statue of Liberty. And the final episode of the series will be an American Candidate Convention held live on the National Mall in Washington around July 4th, 2004. Viewers will determine the winning candidate from among three finalists. Says Kevin Riley, FX's president of entertainment, the series will be seeking the Jesse Venturas of the world, finding messages people want to hear. Hopefully we'll find some very qualified civil servant who lacks a power base and maybe also a plumber from Detroit who tells it like it is. Says R.J. Cutler, producer of the show, it's like a cross between War Room, which he a documentary about the Clinton campaign, which he directed, and American Idol. The game show appears to be inspired by Buenos Aires television channel, which is launching a series called The People's Candidate. Of course, if the winner of the TV show is not guaranteed funding or ability to get on the ballot, that would entail knowing something about how the political system works. But, of course, this is not the end of the deal.
This spring, when all the new shows have turned old, turn to the newest show on television. Fox, the network that invented reality, brings you the biggest dose of reality yet.
What do you think?
I think it's melanoma.
And no, not lymphoma?
Lymphoma's got the fuzzy outline, right? Right?
I don't know, Todd. You always get everything right.
Hi, I'm Dick Clark. I've never done reality TV before, partly because I didn't have the time, partly because there wasn't a show that really grabbed me. This show grabs me. 20 attractive young people from around the country, each with a different background, each with a different idea of how to play the game. Each one wants only one thing, to be the chief cancer specialist at a major Atlanta public hospital. Welcome to American Oncologist.
Each week, new competition.
This time we want you to pick which patient is having real convulsions.
New strategies.
Chrissy, was that prednisone you prescribed to that woman or tamoxifen?
I think it was prednisone.
Yeah. Are you sure?
Brennan, stop it. I know what you're trying to do, and it is so weak.
And each week, the audience gets to choose.
She was the favorite of the nurses, but you voted her out of the hospital. Let's say goodbye to Marcy.
20 contestants.
I'm Todd. I'm a bartender.
I'm Brendan. I'm a consultant.
I'm Chrissy. I'm a bartender.
20 patients.
I like the boy with the spiky hair. He made me do 10 push-ups before I went on the IV.
I could see Todd turning me away at an HMO. I don't know, just something about him.
7 weeks, and you get to vote every week on the Banana Republic American Oncologist Doc Line.
So who do you think read the X-ray better? Give us a call. We're live except on the West Coast.
As real as a heart attack? If only. Here's reality with the most Fox attitude ever.
So join us as we look for the nation's next great new cancer specialist, an American Oncologist.
This spring, because there's never enough Fox.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, with the clicks and the pops and the thing, I will be reading the trades for you from Advertising Age, apropos of ads being everywhere. Pepsi and space shuttle talks. What? I'll read it for you. Don't worry about it. Pepsi Cola Company is negotiating a deal for what could be one of the highest profile promotions in marketing history. An unprecedented $35 million program that would award the winner a ticket to ride on the Russian Soyuz space shuttle. Should it reach agreement on buying a seat on the rocket, the soft drink giant would back the program with a powerhouse marketing budget. Among its plans, a reality TV show with contestants competing to win a trip to space. Is everything everything now, or what? Executives working on PepsiCo's behalf are fashioning a program around the concept and are negotiating with at least one undisclosed network. Said one ad executive, anybody can sponsor a tour, but a seat in space is a very unique opportunity. Said a rival, it's classic Pepsi. They don't mean the one that's less sweet. They mean marketing. Details are being worked out for the promotion, expected to begin in summer 2003 and run through the following year. Pepsi would pay about $15 million for the rights to the ticket. Isn't that, parenthetically, isn't that $5 million less than Lance Bass of NSYNC was supposed to pay? Yes, it is. And another $10 to $20 million to promote the trip. It is unknown how much of that budget would support producing the TV show. The Lance Bass attempt to ride a Soviet rocket failed when none of the corporate sponsors, including one unnamed soft drink company said to be Pepsi, ponied up. One Pepsi bottler said the idea sprouted from Mr. Bass's failed bid through an executive close to Pepsi. Though an executive close to Pepsi said it has tried for several years to work out a space deal, only to be stymied by timing, lack of feasibility, and questions how to promote the deal. Pepsi has dallied in space before. In 1996, it paid the Russians to float a giant Pepsi can outside the Mir space station. Pepsi's push comes as Americans' buying decisions are influenced at every turn by the promotions that marry marketing and entertainment. That's where the TV special fits in. The reality show concept has been a major success for rival Coca-Cola Company, sponsor of American Idol. Pepsi could support a 12 to 18 episode series on a younger skewing network, such as Fox, NBC, or even ABC. Not everyone, though, was wowed by the prospect of Pepsi's plan. One promotion expert said a space shot smacks more of a public relations stunt. Tom Perko, president of beverage consultant Bevmark, suggested that the final frontier had become too mundane to create $35 million worth of buzz. So many have gone up and done the same thing that there is very little drama, he said. There's not enough danger. Not enough novelty. It's not like people can run around a spaceship and fornicate or kill each other or do other things they do on TV. Unquote. Tom Perko of Bevmark. Nice to hear people speak the truth, isn't it? When I read the trades for you, it's a copyrighted feature, ain't it? Yes, it is. And so what if it's not? Hey, legislation hit the House this week that would require TV stations to end analog broadcasting December 30th, 2006. And the legislation would prohibit the FCC from requiring cable operators to carry both analog and digital channels. So, if you don't have an antenna, you won't be getting those digital channels. But don't come crying to me. Ladies and gentlemen, don't come crying to me anyway. That concludes this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time on these same stations, on NPR Worldwide, on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, on shortwave at WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz all up and down the east coast of North America, and around the world on your computer whenever you want it at two locations, www.harryshearer.com and www.kcrw.com. And it would be just like always being the last to know if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty, thank you very much, Email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. The show internet services by Steve Mack. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.